The skyline of Kingston and the hills of Port of Spain do not look like war zones, but for decades these streets operated under a different set of laws. In our history, the line between the ballot box and the bullet has often been blurred. We watched as men rose from the concrete to become more powerful than ministers. They provided the schoolbooks, they settled the domestic disputes, they gave the orders that the police could not counter. But every shadow state eventually faces its sunset. This is not a story of glamorous outlaws or cinematic heists. It is a record of the heavy price paid by our people when the state decides to take back what it gave away. We are looking at the years between 2020 and 2020, a time of reckoning, a time when the kingpins discovered that no matter how deep their roots grew, the earth could still be moved. Chapter 1. The Shadow State. In the early 2000s, the Caribbean was not just a collection of vacation spots. It was a region grappling with a monster it had helped feed. To understand how the gangs fell, we have to understand how they stood. In Jamaica, the power was concentrated in West Kingston, specifically, a place called Tivoli Gardens. This was what we call a political garrison. It was a community built with a specific purpose: to provide a guaranteed block of votes for a political party. In exchange, the state looked the other way. The man at the center of this world was Christopher Koch. Most knew him as Dudas. He was the son of Lester Koch, a man who had pioneered the international drug trade through the Shower Posse. But Dudas was different. He was not a loud man. He did not wear heavy gold or shout in the streets. He was a businessman. He ran a company called Presidential Click. Under his rule, Tivoli Gardens was arguably the safest place in Jamaica for its residents. There was no petty theft. There was no rape. If someone committed a crime, they were brought before the dawn. The punishment was swift and sometimes brutal, but it was consistent. This is the tragedy of our history. The state failed to provide basic security and social services, so the gangs filled the vacuum. For many in West Kingston, the government was a distant, unreliable entity that appeared only during election cycles. The Don was there every day. He paid for the wakes when people died. He paid the school fees for the children. He was the employer, the judge, and the provider. By the mid-2000s, the Presidential Click had become a shadow state. They controlled the peers. They influenced the distribution of government contracts. The world outside Jamaica was watching. The United States Department of Justice saw Dudas not as a community leader, but as one of the most dangerous drug lords in the world. They alleged that he ran a massive distribution network for cocaine and marijuana that stretched from Kingston to New York and Toronto. In August 2009, the United States issued a formal extradition request. This request created a crisis of identity for the Jamaican government. The Prime Minister at the time, Bruce Golding, was the Member of Parliament for the area Dudas controlled. To hand over the Don was to destroy the power base of his own party. For 9 months, the government stalled. They questioned the legality of the evidence. They hired a law firm in the United States to lobby against the extradition. They tried to protect the man who protected the garrison. But the pressure was mounting. The people of Jamaica were tired of being seen as a narco state. The international community was threatening sanctions. The tension in Kingston was palpable. You could feel it in the air. People started stockpiling food. The buses stopped running into certain areas. The shadow state and the actual state were on a collision course. In May 2010, the Prime Minister finally relented. He signed the extradition request. He told the nation he was sorry for the delay and that the rule of law must prevail. But in Tivoli Gardens, the words of a Prime Minister meant very little. The residents did not see a criminal being brought to justice. They saw their benefactor being betrayed. They began to fortify. They piled up old cars and appliances at the entrances to the community. They wired the barricades with explosives. Women dressed in white marched through the streets, declaring that they were willing to die for their leader. The gangs from other parts of the island, groups that were usually rivals, sent gunmen to West Kingston to support the president. They saw this as a fight for the survival of the system that allowed them all to exist. The state had outsourced its authority for 40 years. Now, it was trying to buy it back with blood. The police and the military began to gather at the edges of the community. The orders were clear: enter Tivoli Gardens and arrest Christopher Koch. The residents waited behind their barricades. The gunmen took their positions on the rooftops. They had high-powered rifles and a knowledge of the terrain that the soldiers lacked. They had the loyalty of a population that felt abandoned by the formal system. As the sun went down on May 23rd, 2010, the city fell silent. Everyone knew that the morning would bring a level of violence that the country had not seen since the days of the rebellion. The first shots were fired near the evening. The police stations in the surrounding areas were attacked. The gangs were trying to distract the security forces to draw them away from the stronghold. It didn't work. The state had finally decided that the existence of a shadow state was a greater threat than a civil war. The mortars were moved into position. The helicopters began to circle. The reckoning had begun, and no one knew if the state actually had the strength to win. The morning of May 24th was the day the music stopped. The security forces moved in with a level of ferocity that shocked the nation. But as the smoke rose over West Kingston, the man at the center of the storm was nowhere to be found. Chapter 2. The Tivoli Siege and the Fallout. The assault on Tivoli Gardens was not a standard police operation. It was a military invasion of a sovereign neighborhood. The Jamaican Defense Force used mortars to clear the barricades. They used heavy machinery to tear through the walls. The sound of gunfire was constant for days. The state of emergency was declared, giving the security forces powers they hadn't exercised in decades. Inside the community, it was chaos. The gunmen fought from house to house, but the cost was borne by the civilians. When the smoke cleared, the official death toll was 73. Most were young men. The community was decimated. The residents were rounded up and detained in stadiums. The images coming out of Tivoli Gardens looked like a war zone in a distant country, not a residential neighborhood in the Caribbean. As the soldiers searched the community, they found the infrastructure of a sophisticated criminal empire. They discovered a network of tunnels that allowed gunmen to move between houses without being seen from the street. They found a private jail where the gang held those who broke their laws. They found the ledgers of a business that turned over millions of dollars. The shadow state was real, and it was built on the bones of the community. But the objective of the mission remained unfulfilled. Christopher Koch was gone. He had vanished into the network of safe houses that his money and influence had bought. For merely a month, the most wanted man in the Caribbean was a ghost. The police searched every corner of the island. They offered rewards. They detained his associates. The tension did not leave the city. It simply moved. The fall of the Don came not with a shootout, but with a disguise. In June 2010, a car was stopped at a police checkpoint on the outskirts of Kingston. Inside was a man wearing a woman's wig and a pair of glasses. It was Christopher Koch. He was accompanied by a clergyman who said he was taking the fugitive to the United States Embassy to surrender. The man who had commanded the loyalty of thousands, the man for whom 70 people had died weeks earlier, was captured without a single shot being fired. His capture marked the end of an era in Jamaica. The Don system was not dead, but it was decapitated. The state had proven that it could, if pushed, use overwhelming force to reclaim its territory. Dudas was extradited to New York. He eventually pleaded guilty to racketeering and was sentenced to 20 years in prison. Without his leadership, the presidential clique fractured. The fallout, however, was bitter. The community of Tivoli Gardens was left traumatized. The provider was gone, and the state that had destroyed the neighborhood did not replace the services he had offered. The schools were still failing. The jobs were still non-existent. The fall of the gang leader created a vacuum of power. In the absence of a single kingpin, smaller, more violent factions began to fight over the scraps of the drug trade. We saw a shift in the nature of crime. The old Dons had a code. They valued order because order was good for business. The new generation was different. They were younger, more impulsive, and had no loyalty to the community. The fall of the major gang did not lead to immediate peace. It led to a fragmentation of violence. The monster hadn't been killed. It had been shattered into 100 smaller, hungrier pieces. The Jamaican government faced a massive inquiry into the conduct of the security forces during the incursion. The public was divided. Some saw the operation as a necessary evil to save the country from becoming a failed state. Others saw it as a massacre of the poor to satisfy foreign powers. The reckoning was not just for the criminals, but for the politicians who had used these gangs for decades to maintain their own power. The trial of the state's conscience lasted years. It revealed the deep rot in the system. It showed how the police had worked with the gangs, and how the gangs had been used to suppress political rivals. The fall of Christopher Koch was a victory for the rule of law, but it was a Pyrrhic one. It left the country wondering if the state was truly any better than the men it had replaced. Across the water, in the tween island republic of Trinidad and Tobago, the authorities were watching Kingston burn. They were facing their own rising tide of gang violence. But their gangs were evolving in a different direction. They were not organized around a single charismatic leader in a garrison. They were organized around faith, identity, and the blocks of the urban landscape. And while Jamaica was cleaning up the rubble of Tivoli, Trinidad was about to enter its own period of darkness. The guns in Kingston had gone quiet for the moment, but the lessons of the fall were being ignored in Port of Spain. The Caribbean was about to learn that you cannot simply arrest your way out of a system that you helped build. Chapter 3. The Twin Island Shift. Trinidad and Tobago entered the 2000 with a different kind of criminal problem. While Jamaica had the centralized power of the dons, Trinidad was seeing the rise of a fragmented, religious-based gang structure. The names Rasta City and Unruly ISIS began to dominate the headlines. These were not just gangs, they were identities. They claimed territory in the hills Levantile and the streets of Enterprise. The state's response in Trinidad was the Anti-Gang Act of 2011. For the first time, the police had the power to arrest people simply for being members of a criminal organization. They implemented a state of emergency, similar to what happened in Jamaica, and arrested hundreds of young men. But there was a problem. In Jamaica, they knew who the leader was. In Trinidad, the Hydra had too many heads. The Trinidadian gangs were heavily involved in the ERP and Color 10 government work programs. Just like in Jamaica, state funds were being filtered directly into the hands of gang leaders under the guise of community development. The gangs weren't just fighting the state, they were being funded by it. When the government tried to cut the cord, the murder rate exploded. The fall of the major structures in Trinidad didn't happen through one massive military strike. It happened through internal attrition and a shift in the culture of the streets. The Zesser culture emerged. This was a generation of criminals who didn't care about the community or the long-term business. They wanted the jewelry, the fast cars, and the social media fame. They recorded their crimes on their phones. They taunted their rivals in music videos. The old guard of the Trinidadian underworld, men who had some level of community respect, were being pushed out or killed by teenagers with high-powered weapons. The fall was not a takedown by the police. It was a collapse of the social order within the criminal world itself. The police launched Operation Strike Back, and while they made high-profile arrests, the fragmentation made the problem harder to solve. Every time a leader was killed, three more rose to take his place, each more violent than the last. By 2015, the Caribbean was seeing a new reality. The era of the kingpin was largely over. The states had become more sophisticated in their surveillance. They were working closer with international agencies. The money trails were being followed. In Jamaica, the lottery scamming phenomenon replaced the traditional drug trade for many gangs. It was decentralized, harder to track, and didn't require holding territory. The fall of the gangs changed the landscape of our cities. In Kingston, the garrisons are still there, but they are quieter. The power of the Don is a shadow of what it was in 2005. In Port of Same, the battle lines are constantly shifting. The reckoning we sought, the return of the state to the communities, is still incomplete. We removed the kings, but we left a poverty that crowned them. The legacy of this era is one of missed opportunities. We saw that the state could dismantle a criminal empire if it had the political will. But we also saw that the state had no plan for what came next. The fall of the gangs was a victory for the law, but for the mother in Tivoli Gardens who lost her son, or the shopkeeper in Levantee who still pays protection money to a masked teenager, the victory feels hollow. Our history tells us that crime is a symptom, not the disease. The gangs fell because they became too big for the state to ignore. But the conditions that created them remain. The shadow states are gone, but the shadows are still there. We are living in the aftermath of a war that no one truly won. The kingpins are in foreign prisons, the garrisons are scarred, and the islands are still searching for a peace that doesn't require a state of emergency. The final count of the 20-year reckoning is still being calculated. We have more laws, better equipped police, and fewer legendary outlaws. The same has a deeper right to move from us about it. But as we look at the streets today, we have to ask if we are safer, or if we have simply traded one large, predictable monster for 1,000 small, unpredictable ones. The fall was televised. The recovery is silent, and the streets are waiting to see what rises next.